Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We kind of got snagged up on a word, so I'll get to that word and in context to Madison's comments in the Virginia ratification debates. But before I do, let me give you the phone number to dial in to listen if you cannot stream at a given day or time. Now, let me also say this. I don't have the time to make all the notes of what we talk about and so forth regarding the shows. So my advice is that if you're listening to something and you go, wow, I want to hear the rest of this because I did not get this and I can't be on the phone. I can't actually pick this up in another way at this point in time. So I have to download the podcast or the show. Make note of the day because that's how we put it up on the podcast pages by day. I used to take the time to kind of explain and so forth. And I know that in the grand scheme of things, it may be a couple minutes to do something like that, but it all adds up. And I only have so much time to, you know, do this, make phone calls to, I'm not creating an empire here. What I'm trying to do is get the solution kickstarted and get it moving so that those people who have the responsibility of championing Republic Review and their constitution are the state legislature. So once they start this, then I can start moving into different directions in giving them lateral support and other things that will actually help. I want to be a part of the solution. And so I pose that question to you. Are you a part of the solution or a part of the problem? If you're not engaged in the solution, then you're still a part of the problem. And unfortunately, I know that doesn't bode well with some people. Well, do something about it. Get involved. No longer sit there idly by and just let things just take their natural course. What the natural course is, and history proves this, the natural course is the loss of liberty. That every society that has built itself on the principles of liberty has ended up losing its liberties to despotism and to just evil people. So let's not allow these things to slip by. And the only way that we won't allow them to slip by is by getting engaged. Because if you're not a part of the solution, then you are allowing things to slip by. With that, let me poke one more, plug one more time. We are trying to grow the listenership and the people involved in getting this message and so forth. Please, if you know somebody that is a champion that loves the Constitution, like-minded or what have you, please talk to them real quick about Republic Review and the content that we're providing so that they can understand and come to the well. And the well of knowledge is not GR necessarily this show, but this is where we're giving you those resources, those fountains of knowledge, which are the ratification debates. So by all means, come, sample, listen. The reason I read these things is I do not want you to take my word for it. I want you to hear what Madison said so that you go, oh my gosh, is it that simple? And yes, it is. Yes, it is. And so we're going to go ahead and dive into what Madison said. But yet, in our previous episode, I hate using the word yesterday, tomorrow, and those types of things, because you never know when we span weekends, when we span things in time and so forth, we, don't necessarily translate in time. So we go by episodes. At least that's what I'm trying to focus on, trying to get better at that. And Madison used the word reprobated. And that word reprobated is kind of an interesting word, and I will give you the basic definition. An unprincipled person, often used humorously or unaffectionately, but in another context, in the archaic, or probably how Madison may have meant it, is a sinner who is not of the elect and is predestined to damnation. So Even if they unanimously reprobated it, in other words, basically sent it to damnation, were it such a government as it suggested, it would now be binding on the people of the state without having had the privilege of deliberating it. So he's basically talking about, you know, this constitution, and had it been just one of those things, it needed just a majority rule and that it could force sovereign states. But it was never, the constitution was never designed to force any state. Every state had to ratify to become a part of the union. You had to be a buy-in. You had to be a stakeholder. Rhode Island was not a part of the union. They were not being taxed. They were just sitting surrounded by states in the union and not being a participant in this Republican form of government. They were autonomous. And understanding that, they weren't forced. They were not compelled. They never had to. The fact of the matter is states can secede. States can actually leave the union. I was talking to somebody this past weekend. You know, California could secede if we actually take back the Constitution the way it needs to be done. And I go, well, that's interesting. So California might be able to secede, but you have to understand that that coastline is pretty important to us. And I'm not sure if the federal government would want to relinquish necessarily the security and so forth that's regarding that coastline. But understanding that states cannot be compelled, that would be an interesting one. And I don't think it would be worthy of a civil war, but I truly believe that it would force the people in California, if they seceded, it would probably go to the throes of, and that's where an actual revolution may occur, where California would probably be, well, I'll just say this, that it will probably be decided by those who have the political force necessary to get the government in the direction they want. Now, will that mean the drug cartels? Will that mean the patriots who are armed and so forth, the demand that they, you know, stand up for their liberties once again? Who knows? But the bottom line is that these problems are state problems, and they have to be resolved at the state level. Anyway, what I wanted to do is I wanted to go into this this concept of the hybrid concept of this republic. Madison goes on and says this: by the new system, a majority of states cannot introduce amendments, nor all of the states required for the purpose. 3/4 of them must concur in alterations. In this, there is a departure from the federal idea. The members to the National House of Representatives are to be chosen by the people at large in proportion to the numbers of their respective districts. When we come to the Senate, its members are elected by the states and in their equal political capacity. But had the government been completely consolidated, the Senate would have been chosen by the people in their individual capacity in the same manner of the members of the House. So what we now have is a consolidated government that is consolidated based on the people. No longer are we recognizing the sovereignty of the states. In other words, the 17th Amendment actually flies in the face of the concept of state sovereignty. And it's amazing how people have not, you know, gone down this path of saying, we've got to undo this. That's why there is an article on reclaimingtherepublic.org on the Constitutional Articles page regarding rescinding the 17th Amendment instead of the repealing it. And so I'd challenge anybody to go read that so you understand that we're not in a position where we have to repeal it. We've been given the blessing of being able to rescind it. And that article will go into that. But Madison goes on and says this: thus, it is of a complicated nature, and this complication, I trust, will be found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation, as well as of a mere confederacy. If Virginia was separated from all the states, her power and authority would extend to all cases, So if California seceded, its power would then extend to all cases. In like manner, were all powers vested in the general government, it would be consolidated government, but the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So in other words, what Madison just said here in this short one sentence, half a paragraph, whatever, definitely the framers and the people back then were the kings of run-on sentences. You think I'm bad. So anyway, Madison clarifies exactly where the jurisdiction of the federal government lies. It is dependent upon the enumerated powers. If it is not an enumerated power, they have no jurisdiction over the matter. And it's that simple. Okay? So the next time we get into this comment, we get into more enumerated jurisdiction, and he says this. This is Madison as well. Madison continues, and this is on the 6th of June. Madison says, "But, sir, on whom does this general government depend? It derives its authority from these governments and from the same sources." Well, I just started digging into this one, and this is pretty good. So this talks about the authority derived and so forth. So we will when we come back, we will restart this part or this thought over again. So please stay tuned, and we're listening and hearing Madison talk about the Constitution, limitations, and so forth. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
So just remember, there are those who are reprobated. I think that's a good word. I think that's a word that we should probably use when we're talking about Democrats, those predestined to damnation. Anyway, as I continue with what Madison said, let's start over from the top. But it is urged that its consolidated nature, joined to the power of direct taxation, will give it a tendency to destroy all subordinate authority, that its increasing influence will speedily enable it to absorb the state governments. I cannot think that this will be the case. If the general government were wholly independent upon the governments of the particular states, then indeed usurpation might be expected to the fullest extent. But, sir, on whom does the general government depend? It derives its authority from these governments and from the same sources from which their authority is derived, from us the people. The members of the federal government are taken from the same men from whom those of the state legislatures are taken. If we consider the mode in which the federal representatives will be chosen, we shall be convinced that the general will never destroy the individual governments. And this conviction must be strengthened by an attention to the construction of the Senate. The representatives will be chosen probably under the influence of the members of the state legislatures. But there is not the least probability of that the election of the latter will be influenced by the former. 160 members represents this commonwealth in one branch of the legislature, are drawn from the people at large, and must ever possess more influence than the few men who will be elected to the general legislature. The reasons offered on this subject by a gentleman on the same side, who he's referring to as Mr. George Nicholas, were unanswerable and have been so fully that I shall add but little more on the subject. Those who wish to become federal representatives must depend on their credit with that class of men who will be the most popular in their counties. Do you understand? He broke it down to the counties, because your districts are based upon, in the state, counties, who generally represent the people in the state governments. They can, therefore, never succeed in any measure contrary to the wishes of those on whom they depend. It is almost certain, therefore, that the deliberation of the members of the Federal House of Representatives will be directed to the interest of the people of America. As to the other branch, the senators will be appointed by the legislatures, and though elected for 6 years, I do not conceive that they will soon forget the source from whence they derived their political existence. This election of one branch of the federal by the state legislatures secures an absolute dependence of the former on the latter. The biennial exclusion of one-third will lessen the facility of a combination and may put a stop to intrigues. I appeal to our past experience whether they will attend to the interests of their constituent states. Have not those gentlemen who have been honored with seats in Congress often signalized themselves by their attachment to their seats? I wish the government may answer the expectation of its friends and foil the apprehensions of its enemies. I hope the patriotism of the people will continue and be a sufficient guard to their liberties. That is such a profound statement. That patriotism of the people will continue and be a sufficient guard to their liberties. I believe its tendency will be that the state governments will counteract the general interests and ultimately prevail. The number of the representatives is yet sufficient for our safety and will gradually increase if we consider their different sources of information. The number will not appear too small. Now, the next comment we have, before I bring up the next comment, let me plug this, because I don't do this very often. We do have a listen line. And so for you to listen to these ratification debates as yours truly murders them and butchers them, because I know I'm not the most polished reader, I'm not the most polished entertainer, but if you garner what I am saying, then you will actually seek these documents out for yourself, you will read these, and you will have as equal, if not more profound understanding as yours truly. But the listen line is 605-562-4209. And so our next comment is going to come from, let me see here, Well, it's going to be Mr. Lee of Westmoreland, and this is on, this is Safety in the Union by Mr. Madison, and Mr. Madison says this. Mr. Madison then recapitulated many instances of the prevalent persuasions of the wisest patriots of the states that the safety of all America depended on union and that the government of the United States must be possessed of an adequate degree of energy or that otherwise their connection could not be justly dominated, dominated a union. He likewise enumerated the expedients that had been attempted by the people of America to form an intimate association from the meeting at New York in the year 1754 and downwards, that their sentiments on the subject have been uniform, both in the colonial and the independent conditions, and that a variety of causes has hitherto prevented the adoption of an adequate system. And now they're being presented with an adequate system. So now Mr. Lee, and this is on June 9th, Mr. Lee talks about, the first thing he talks about is the militia. He also gets into enumerations and some other things, but let's start off with this. Our men fighting with the troops of that king whom he so much admires. I have seen proofs of the wisdom of that paper on your table. I have seen incontrovertible evidence that that militia cannot always be relied upon. I could enumerate many instances, but one will suffice. Let the gentleman recollect the action of Guilford. The American regular troops behaved there with the most gallant intrepidity. What did the militia do? The great number of them fled. Their abandonment of the regulars occasioned the loss of the field. Had the line been supported that day, Cornwallis, instead of surrendering at Yorktown, would have laid down his arms at Guilford. And so he kind of points out that there is problems with the militia, but those problems could have been fortified and strengthened had they actually set standards and they supported it. But you got to understand, when the general government, after the second or the end of the Revolutionary War, the Treaty of Ghent, when there was really no need for the militia to be used, what did they do? Well, they created their own internal force called the U.S. Cavalry to actually police and enforce the laws of the territories until states became states. Well, they did have, one, the ability, but they did not have the constitutional power to create some entity other than the militia for enforcing laws of the Union. And so at that point in time, when they started creating the cavalry, when they started going down this path of creating other entities other than using the militia, it was their ignoring of the Constitution and the militia that actually enabled this concept of surrendering, or actually, I shouldn't even sort of say surrender. They put aside the militia and they put aside our checks and balances and they started enforcing it themselves. At that point in time, the people never woke up. And it's time for us to wake up now and say, sorry, you have to use the militias. We have to restore the militias to the power and to the base that they need to be as necessary for this union and for this republic. And so it is that important to understand that, you know, after that second end or the end of the Revolutionary War, the Treaty of Ghent, they really didn't see a need. So what did they end up doing with the money instead of equipping and training the militia? What did they end up doing with that? Well, they ended up actually going down this path of providing, you know, money for doing other things. And so what they ended up doing was they ended up actually ignoring the Constitution and the militia, and they started applying money for roads and money for things that they probably shouldn't have been doing. They were probably violations of the Constitution, but they were saving money. And if you look at it, Andrew Jackson got the credit for getting us supposedly out of debt. But what he was actually doing was he was no longer maintaining a militia. He was setting us up so that when we actually did go into full skirmishes for the Civil War over the abolition of slavery, we were ill-prepared as militias to be able to stand and do what needed to be done. Now, the problem was, and this is what should have happened, I will say this time and time again, this may be, you know, armchair quarterbacking, but the fact of the matter is, when the state seceded, that's when Abraham Lincoln should have declared an abolition of slavery in the Western Hemisphere and then gone after the states for those who were practicing it, not to force them into the Union, but to say, you have no business enslaving people in this hemisphere, using the Monroe Doctrine, which is about national security and what is best. So anyway, we'll get back right after these two promos. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so Mr. Lee of Westmoreland is still speaking, and this is what he says. He says, I say that this new system shows in stronger terms than words could declare that the liberties of the people are secure. It goes on the principle that all powers in the people and that rulers have no powers but what are enumerated in that paper. When a question arises with respect to the legality of any power exercised or assumed by Congress, it is plain on the side of the governed. Is it enumerated in the Constitution? If it be, it is legal and just. It is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional if it's not enumerated. I just added that. Candor must confess, and let me just do this. Yeah, candor must confess that it is indefinitely more attentive to the liberties of the people than any state government, because most state governments do not have really well-defined enumerated powers. Mr. Lee then said that under the state governments, the people reserve to themselves certain enumerated rights, and that the rest were vested in the rulers, that consequently the powers reserved to the people but were an inconsiderable exception from what were given to their rulers. but that in the federal government, the rulers of the people were vested with certain defined powers, and that what were not delegated to those rulers were retained by the people. The consequence of this, he said, was that the limited powers were only an exception to those which rested in the people, and that they knew what they had given up and could be in no danger. He exemplified the proposition in a similar manner. He observed that if a man delegated certain powers to an agent, it would be an insult upon common sense to suppose that the agent could legally transact any business for his principal which was not contained in the commission whereby the powers were delegated. But that if a man empowered his representative or agent to transact all businesses except certain enumerated parts, the clear result was that the agent could lawfully transact every part of his principal's business except the enumerated parts, and then added that these plain propositions were sufficient to demonstrate the inutility and folly were it be permitted to the use of a Bill of Rights. And if you understand the real problem people were standing up with these limitations was the fact that we didn't have a Bill of Rights. Now, when I was talking to Bob Zadek about 2 years ago, we were talking about, because he wrote a book that the anti-federalists were right during the ratification debates, that what they were asserting was true. Actually not. What was asserted by the federalists was what was accepted and what was true. The fact of the matter is because we allowed because the people of America and the state governments allowed the obfuscation of their terms and definitions as they defined them in the ratification process. And because these things were buried, that the federal government and other people who had designs, machinations in trying to aggrandize their power and their place in history, well, those men sold us downriver by basically continuing or even obscuring further the importance of those ratification debates and how they defined everything. And so I just can't go on enough about how we were sold downriver by these men and politicians, lawyers, bankers, businessmen who were seeking benefits for themselves. But the bottom line is, because it's a contract and the contract has only one mechanism of altering it, the contract still exists and is intact. We can enforce that contract to the letter. All we have to do is say, comply to the Constitution or be gone. It's that simple. It is literally that simple. Any public servant that chooses not to comply to the Constitution and work within the boundaries of that Constitution. If you want to give the people health care, you either amend the Constitution or you stop. You can no longer take a penny, tax us for anything, or tell us that we have to spend money on health care. You have no power over that. So anyway, let me move on to what Mr. George Nicholas then says. And let me see. This is on June 10th, where Mr. Nicholas kind of steps up and he says this: the gentleman has adverted to what he calls the sweeping clause and etc., and represents it as replete with great dangers. And so it's when he says replete, he means just full of these great dangers. It's just, you know, it's busting at the seams from these dangers. He says this dreaded clause runs in the following words, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof, close quote. The committee will perceive that the Constitution had enumerated all the powers which the general government should have, but it did not say how they were to be exercised. It therefore, in this clause, tells how they shall be exercised. Does this one, so here, I'll give you one on the militia. The militia says, or the Constitution says, subsection 15, that Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia. So, it doesn't mean Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia by creating the FBI or by creating the ATF to go enforce the laws. No, they shall have the power, so they have the ability to create a law and or mechanism in calling forth the militia, letting the states know we need the militia to go and exercise these laws or to execute these laws, to enforce these laws. That's the only thing that they can write. Those are the only kinds of laws that they can make or create, because those have to be, the laws have to be in pursuant to the Constitution. If they are not in pursuance to the Constitution, in other words, they're not regarding those enumerated powers and they're not directly tied to those enumerated powers, then they're unconstitutional laws. They're violating the Constitution. And in today's matter, when it comes to immigration and those types of things, their failure to do so is supporting rebellion against the Constitution. It's that simple, and they can be removed. And that's all we've got to do, folks. We just got to start removing all of them, because the 14th Amendment, Section 3, gets into that. But let me go on to what Mr. Nicholas is saying. He says, does this give any new power? I say not. Suppose it had been inserted at the end of every power that they should have power to make laws to carry that power into execution. Would this have increased their powers? If, therefore, it could not have increased their powers if placed at the end of each power, it cannot increase them at the end of all. This clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but gives them no additional power. But it is objected to for a want of a Bill of Rights. It is a principle universally agreed upon that all powers not given are retained, whereby the Constitution, the general government, has general powers for any purpose. Its powers are absolute. Where it has powers with some exceptions, they are absolute only as to those exceptions. In either case, the people retain what is not conferred on the general government, as it is by their positive grant that it has any of its powers. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to be an enumerated right of the people to determine. Are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights and etc.? If not, they are generally speaking within the king's prerogative. Now, just to change this, in disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. And so he goes on, and it suffice it to say that what he ends up saying here is, you know, to me, I think it just closes or seals the deal, if you understand what I'm saying. Because to me, Congress cannot meddle with it because it is not an enumerated power. To me, that's like an absolute line. And so what I really want you to garner out of this is that, as he lays it out, in England, they had to go to the Magna Carta. Is this something protected by the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights? If it's not a protected right, then the king had all the prerogative and Parliament had all the prerogative as to whether they were going to allow you to do something or not. In America, it goes down to, is the power enumerated in the Constitution? If it's not enumerated in the Constitution, then the federal government has no jurisdiction over it and cannot meddle with those powers not enumerated, such as religion, such as speech, such as assembly, such as the right to bear arms and those types of things. The federal government had no power over anything that was not enumerated. And like I said, he hit it out of the park. When we come back, we will have some more Virginia ratification debates. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so one of the things that was probably really contested to a great degree were taxes, direct taxes. Now, I talk to people, you know, that feel like they're an authority on the Constitution, and I may be a pretty well-versed person on the Constitution, but I never try to say I'm the foremost authority or even consider myself an authority. But I'm very well-versed on the Constitution in contrast to most people because I'm still learning. And until the day I die, I will continue to learn. And as I learn, I am constantly amazed at the design of this document and how well these men argued and discussed and illuminated these nuances of the Constitution, like this concept of direct taxes. You know, the word direct taxes never, I don't think, actually exists in the Constitution. But what they did do was they created the power to collect taxes, to lay taxes and collect them. And that's the same thing as a direct tax. And so the argument was, you know, hey, this is just like ludicrous. We can't have a federal government be just applying direct taxes. And James Monroe was one of the biggest anti-federalists against direct taxation. And so this, and I bring that up because they're going to reference him and his comments. But this right here is Mr. George Nicholas regarding direct taxation. He says this: another argument made use of is that ours is the largest state and we may pay in proportion to other states. How does that appear? The proportion of taxes are fixed by the number of inhabitants and not regulated by the extent of territory or fertility of soil. If we be wealthier in proportion than any other states, it will fall lightly higher upon us than upon poorer states. They must fix the taxes so that the poorest states can pay, and Virginia being richer will bear it easier. The honorable gentleman says that the first collections are to go to Congress and that the state legislatures must bear all deficiencies. How does this appear? Does he prove it? Nothing of it appears in the plan itself. The Congress and the states have concurrent jurisdictions in laying and collecting taxes. This is no rule that shows that Congress shall have the first collections. Each is independent of each other. Another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from the clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included with this union according to the representative numbers, close quote. So I guess there's the words of direct taxes in the Constitution, but it doesn't lay out exactly how. And as a matter of fact, what happened when taxes were, when there was the first rebellion in paying taxes? Did they create an IRS to go collect taxes for the Whiskey Rebellion? No. What George Washington did was he mustered up and got the militia together, and they went up into the hills and wherever the rebellion was occurring, the people who refused to pay the taxes, and arrested them for failure to follow the constitutional laws. And so they used the militia for enforcement of those laws. That isn't a point here, but it is a point that the only authority in exercising the laws of the Union that are pursuant to the Constitution is the militia. They cannot create their own policing forces. They cannot enforce their own laws themselves. They have to call upon the militia. But anyway, what Mr. Nicholas goes on and says is each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax. As it was justly observed by the gentleman over the way, Mr. Randolph, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They arc limited, and instead of arc, it's R. It's just a typo. And I found some other typos. I just you try to adapt to them. But anyway, they are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies, and officers are accountable to each government for the different collections. Now, I must say that in regards to taxes, I'll say this, that the state legislatures were the ones that actually paid the federal government, because up until the 16th Amendment, people didn't pay the federal government directly. It was the state government that would then pay. And so the collection was literally done by the states and then paying those taxes to the federal government. The only time there was an enforcement, like I said, was it was always enforced by the militia. Anyway, Mr. George Nicholas then says this, quote, the taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states, like I just said, within the time agreed upon by the United States in Congress assembled. Now, sir, by a comparison of this article with the clause in the Constitution, we shall find them to be nearly the same. The common defense and general welfare are the objects expressly mentioned to be provided for in both systems. The power in the Confederation to secure and provide for those objects was constitutionally unlimited. The requisitions of Congress are binding on the states, though from the imbecility of their nature, they cannot be enforced. The same power is intended by the Constitution. The only difference between them is that Congress is, by this plan, to impose the taxes on the people, whereas by the Confederation, they are laid by the states. the amount to be raised and the power given to raise it is the same principle. The mode of raising only is different, and this difference is founded on the necessity of giving the government that energy. Without it cannot exist. The power has not been reprobated. In other words, it's not predestined to damnation, right? The power has not been predestined to damnation in the Confederation. It ought not to be blamed in the proposed plan of government. And so Mr. Pendleton then brings up this concept of direct taxes as well. And this is what he says. A gentleman, Mr. Monroe, has said that the power of direct taxation was unnecessary because the impost and back lands would be abundantly sufficient to answer all federal purposes. If so, what are we disputing about? I asked the gentleman who made the observation and this committee if they believe the Congress will ever lay direct taxes if the other funds are sufficient. It will then remain a harmless power upon paper and do no injury. If it should be necessary, will the gentleman run the risk of the Union by withholding it? I was sorry to hear the subjects of this requisition and taxation misinterpreted. The latter has been compared to taxation by Great Britain without our own consent. The two cases are by no means similar. The King of Great Britain has not the purse, though he holds the sword. He has no means of using the sword by requisition on those who uphold the purse. He applied to the British Parliament, and they were pleased to trust him with their money. We declared, as we had a right, that we ought not to be taxed by our own representation, and therefore are their disposing of our money without our consent was unjust. Here, requisitions are to be made by one body of our representatives to another. Why should this be the case when they are both possessed of our equal confidence, both chosen in the same manner and equally responsible to us? But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies, equally our representatives, and the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners for different purposes. The general government in great national concerns in which are interested in common with the members of the Union. The state legislatures in out mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers, our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property, as Virginians are still in the hands of our state legislatures. Now you can't say that anymore. If you understand where they are with the gun grabbing and everything else, then their safety is not, it is in the hands, and they need to actually replace them. But anyway, if they prove to be feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. Also, there you go. If your state legislatures are failing to do their job in supporting the Constitution, then you're supposed to go to Congress. But Congress is corrupt, too. So then what you do is, and that's why we're going to get into the grand jury and enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. With that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll finish where we left off in our next episode. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.